I am calling this meeting of the Children and Families Committee to order. It's good to have everybody back. And I would like the individuals engaging in their filthy side conversations to pay attention. There we go.
The co-chair notes that he was speaking to his own GOP membership.
Yes. Thank you all over there. So, good to have everyone back. It's different times, so I've been asked by the sergeant's office to read the following. Signs and placards are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts and shouting is only appropriate for members and not the general public. Disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Applause or other audible demonstrations are not allowed. For safety reasons, standing or sitting in walkways, aisles, or standing or obstructing at your chair is prohibited. If you require any accommodation whatsoever, please speak with our sergeant's staff. They are identified by gold ties, as you will see in the corner. Troopers and house security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety. Those providing testimony will be given specific time limits, which must be strictly observed. If you receive an entrance ticket, please retain it as it may be required for re-entry if you leave the hearing room. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in removal from the hearing room. Our goal is to conduct these proceedings efficiently while ensuring everyone has the opportunity to observe and participate appropriately. Thank you for your cooperation and participation in the legislative process.
Thank you, Chair West. Now, before we get started today, I would like to take a moment to recognize and introduce those that are new to the committee. And I also think that, given how animated you are reading that introduction, that your daughters must be very lucky to have you read bedtime stories.
It's pretty dramatic.
So, new to the staff of the committee, we have Ryan Woods, who is our new GOP committee administrator. Welcome. She joins us from Washington State, and we're thrilled to have her. We also have Aaron Bursey, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, Aaron. Thank you. Yep, we're also thrilled to have you, GOP researcher, and Laura Falone Day, who is the legislative analyst with House Research Nonpartisan. And we have two new pages on the committee as well. So Lydia will be staffing the committee on Tuesdays. She's not here today, but Mira is here today. She's over here. And so if you need anything, feel free to reach out to Lydia or Mira, and they'll be happy to assist. Thank you for joining us. Thank you, as always, to our great returning staff this year, too, especially our nonpartisan team that have double the work in this tied Minnesota House. Doug Berg, our fiscal analyst, Sarah Sunderman, a legislative analyst, and Danielle Pugnelli, a legislative analyst. Other exciting interim updates, Representative Amanda Hemmingson-Yeager left us for the other body and is now Senator Hemmingson-Yeager. But we are thrilled to welcome Representative XP Lee. Representative Lee, if you'd like to just give a brief introduction of yourself and share about what you look forward most about joining the Children and Families Committee.
Yeah, no, thank you so much, co-chairs.
Is your mic on in this room? We have to flip the mic.
Flipped it on, yeah. Okay. Oh, should I lean in more? Okay. Thank you so much for the opportunity. My name is XP. It's just XP. I know the lower P kind of throws people off, but it's just, it's like JJ or something like that. It's short for Xiong Pao, so it's a nickname I've had for a long time. Funny story, I got it when, Windows XP came out, so. Yeah. So it stuck. But it's cool. I like it. Brooklyn Park, Coon Rapids, Champlin, great area. Brooklyn Park is I call it the most diverse area in the whole state, where minority majority, along with Brooklyn Center, also minority majority, great diversity there, one of our biggest strengths. It's always been still emotional. Yesterday was beautiful. Speaker Hortman was not just a loss for the legislature, but for all of Minnesota. All the words that were said and shared, and her legacy will continue to reverberate for decades to come. I'm not here to, you know, take her space per se, but to try to follow in her footsteps. I was born a refugee in Nong Cai, naturalized when I was 18. So I was able to take the oath of citizenship. And so from the dirt floors of my refugee camp to the marble halls of the Capitol, I've shared my story along the way. And I'm really proud to be able to be here. This is a great committee. One of my top ones that I was hoping Zach would give me. And, you know, really looking forward to it. Had a child, our first child myself. He's 1 year. I'm starting my own parenting journey. But I've always had a lot of nephews and nieces. And I started in my professional life in youth nonprofit programs. So, especially working with younger boys, I really make sure that, you know, they have a healthy development is a passion of mine as well. So thank you for the opportunity.
Wonderful. Well, we are thrilled to have you. And although we will forever grieve the loss of Speaker Hartman, I know that your district is in good hands. So, all right, moving on.
The next order of business is approval of the minutes from the last time we met. So, Representative Nelson, would you like to move the minutes from Tuesday, April 10th?
Yes, Chair West, I would like to move the minutes from the previous meeting.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted.
Right. Members, today the plan is to hear from the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. They will start with some implementation updates on the SSIS, or Social Services Information System, and on the Child Care Electronic Attendance Record Keeping. First, we have Jennifer Sommerfeld joining us. Go ahead and get settled, and when you're ready, please introduce yourself for the record and continue on.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jennifer Sommerfeld. I'm the Government Relations Director at the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, and I'm glad to be here with my colleague Randy Keyes to welcome you back, I guess, to the legislature. We're excited to be back this year. So we have been asked to provide an update on a number of issues, including child welfare IT modernization and electronic attendance record keeping, and then also our licensing modernization project. So I'm going to start us off today with child welfare IT modernization. So since July of this year, and to be honest with you, before that, the department has been undergoing a lot of work planning for implementation of a new child welfare information system, or CWIS. Since July 1, we have done a fair amount of work to move us down that process. Before we can implement a new IT solution, a lot of planning and readiness work must be maintained, or must be completed and approved by the federal government if we are to maintain our 50% matching funds. An important early step we took, which you can see on the slide, was the development of our Comprehensive Child Welfare Information System Planning Advanced Planning Document, or PAPD. So I know it's a strange title to have planning in there twice, but they use APDs a lot. The federal government approved our PAPD document on November 18th, which means we are right now approved for the 50% match from the federal government for all of our planning activities as we develop the system. The federal government approved that on the 18th of November. And as part of our work for modernization, we have also selected a planning vendor to support agency efforts for development of an RFP, which includes our system requirements, and then will also be helping us develop our implementation advanced planning document, or our IAPD, that when it's complete will be submitted to the federal government for approval for our 50% match for implementation of the system. DCYF and Minute have also engaged and facilitated with 38 focus groups that include more than 300 participants from across the state, including counties and tribes that currently use SSIS. Through that engagement, more than 1,000 pain points, believe it or not, I know those who've worked on SSIS for a while are probably aware, but more than 1,000 pain points were raised in the focus groups that have been used to inform the new system requirements. And that has allowed us to develop all the requirements that we're going to put into our RFP. Those requirement sections are under review right now by more than 60 individuals from state and local agencies to gather feedback and determine if there's any adjustments needed or if those are accurately reflecting what people feel needs to be a system requirement. And then one final end-to-end review of that will occur in April, at which point we hope to, in May, submit our IAPD to the federal government for approval. We've also created a CWIS steering committee that includes counties, tribes, financial operations, and representatives from state agencies, including DCYF, DHS, and MINIT, to work on project governance and planning. And then we've created a CWIS team that's coming together, including fiscal and data product owners, a budget coordinator, and an engagement coordinator. Planning is underway for future product team positions and support positions that will be needed during and after implementation to support change management and training with local governments. And that CWIS team has ongoing and regular engagement with the CWIS team that I mentioned, the CWIS Steering Committee, MACSA Leadership, the American Indian Child Welfare Advisory Council, and both DCYF and MINIT executive leadership. Sorry, I'm working off of two documents here. So this slide shows you what the next steps are for SSIS modernization. First, we're going to be finalizing the RFP through partnership with the vendor, along with the IAPD, and as I said, we'll be submitting those in May. Looking at what other states have done and how long it has taken them approval, federal approval takes at least 2 months for that IAPD document. Throughout the work, state agency staff will continue what we've been doing for a while, which is data cleanup and conversion planning and other readiness work to support the transition of data from the current SSIS system to the new CWIS system when it's ready to go. We're also doing organizational change work with local agencies to prepare them for CWIS implementation. That work's ongoing, and we are doing a lot of work to evaluate processes and practices that are in the system to determine if they can or should be updated. So I know people have said to us these words, please don't bring a 1980s or 1990s practice system into a new 2025 system. And so that's kind of what that work is looking at. And then once we have approval from the federal government of the IAPD, procurement and contracting for the CWIS will begin. That will include a number of federal review periods, and we understand that takes an average of 18 months based on data that we've received from 13 states. So we're lining up right now resources across MINIT and DCYF to see if we can do that in as short a period as possible. And we do expect to begin contracting work with the CWIS vendor in 2027. So that kind of concludes the SSIS update. You want me to stop at the end of each portion if there are questions, Mr. Chair?
Thank you. I guess we can take a brief pause. It looks like Representative Nitto, you have a question. Go ahead.
Thank you. Just one question. Is this going to be one selected vendor? Do you put this out, or are there a number of people that can do this work in SSIS, or is it a sole source contract?
Jennifer.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Commissioner.
Representative, there are a number of vendors that can do this type of work. That's why we put out the RFP, but my understanding currently is that we'll use one vendor to set up the platform.
All right. Any follow-up, Representative Nadeau? Yep. All right. Great. Feel free to proceed.
Thank you. So I'll move on to electronic attendance records, which will be even briefer, which I know people love. So, oh my gosh. Apologies. So I apparently don't know how to operate my computer and this at the same time, so apologies for that. So I'm going to start with briefly a timeline for how we got to where we are right now in electronic attendance record keeping. In 2019, a study and report, the legislature requested that we do a study and report on how we would establish electronic records keeping. And in that report, which we brought back to the legislature 2 years later, the report identified the need that before we could even approach electronic attendance records, we needed to centralize registration of CCAP providers. So in 2023, we received funding to do that work, and that centralized registration was rolled out last year in April of 2025. And So that was work we started in 2023. And then in 2025, as you'll all probably remember, we came back last year and sought funding for implementing electronic attendance records. So that's kind of how we got to where we are today. And where we are right now is that we are working with the software vendor to implement the electronic attendance record keeping. We expect that to be rolled out starting in June of this year. We will begin requiring some child care providers that receive CCAP payments to submit records at that time, and then we'll be rolling it out to ensure that the system is working properly, that providers know how to use it, that they have proper training, and we don't have a lot of glitchiness when it first starts. And the expected outcome will be that we'll be able to flag abnormalities and cross-check records. We'll be able to make regular compliance checks substantially easier and allow for increased oversight and more comprehensive investigations.
Director Sommerfeld, do you or the department, do we have any idea what that rollout might look like? Are we going to start with the centers who have the largest population of families who receive child care assistance, or is it going to be kind of like the reverse where folks who have a smaller population and kind of roll just in terms of, you know, if there are issues with the software and that sort of thing?
Yeah, so it's my understanding we're going to start with the larger child care providers, and we have committed to providers that will give 90 days notice before they will become part of the rollout. So we want to make sure this operates as smoothly as possible for people who would be involved in doing it.
Absolutely. I think that that is going to be a great step in the right direction for us to make sure that the providers who receive the highest amount of state dollars will be the first ones to try out the system so that we can have that additional step of oversight. Chair West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that end, what is the threshold for, are you taking number of kids or total amount? And if so, like how many kids or what's the total amount for selecting the CCAP providers that are front of the line?
I'm going to pass that off to my colleague to answer if you have the answer.
Go ahead.
Chair.
I apologize. Can you please introduce yourself for the record? Because I did not.
My name is Randy Keyes. I'm the Inspector General at Department of Children, Youth, and Families. Our initial plan is to roll it out to like about 100 providers in the first wave. That'll give us a good sample, and we'll be able to see what works. It's, I think we're doing it primarily on revenue, but some of that work is being done now to try to do the planning on how that's going to actually roll out.
Thank you. Follow-up?
A quick bundle.
Yep.
One follow-up into that and another question. So there'll be, you haven't decided on a dollar amount that will be the set number for providers who have to comply immediately. And then assuming everything goes smoothly, when do we estimate that this will roll out to all providers?
Inspector General.
Chair. So some of this planning is pretty preliminary. And I'm sort of on the edge of it because it's the CCAP program staff that are leading the first step on rolling it out. But we've talked about 100 as a number of people, not set on a dollar amount or number of children, but the 100 sort of largest providers. And then the next wave, we would bring in another couple hundred and continue to roll out. And at some point, as we get to really small providers, we have to decide if there's an economic value to continuing to do it.
Inspector General and Chair West, if I'm overstepping, but how can you give us a little bit more detail on what you mean by an economic benefit to continuing to do it? Like people, like centers who might not be, like they only have a few children who are receiving child care assistance, and then is there a monetary cost to the state for every provider who utilizes the system or like per account? Can you speak to that?
So, Chair, a little bit.
Okay.
And we may have to come back to you with some more details. But as we get to the small family providers that have one child, we have to understand, part of what we're trying to understand is there a cost to the provider, right? We need to understand if there's any technology costs that providers have to adopt. And so the discovery process is going on right now with the vendor. And as we figure out what the system looks like and what the requirements are to use it, then we'll have a better understanding of what the cost is and if there's an economic place to cut it off.
Thank you. That's helpful. Follow-up, Chair West.
That was basically the question I had, so we're good there. The expectation that I have, and I'm not positive, I think we probably agree, is the threshold should be pretty low, there might be a cost of compliance of having some sort of software, but the idea of saving time, you know, like electronic attendance is a lot easier and faster to do than maintaining paper records, like even if you only have a few children. So maybe one doesn't make sense, but I would like to see that be as a very, very low number to where it ends on. And assuming everything goes perfectly, do you have a ballpark on the timeline?
Inspector General or Director?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I don't know that we have a timeline right now, but we can certainly get back to you on that one.
That'd be great. Representative McDonald, you have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The IG, I would imagine your office has been quite busy the last year or two, or maybe in the last 6 months. Is there a way, without waiting for the outcome and this to roll out, that we are doing, your office is doing the best to prevent and end the fraud that has been so prevalent in the state of Minnesota and in the news the last probably 6 months, but to be sure?
Inspector General, I think he's talking about the alleged fraud. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, member.
No, excuse me, Madam Chair. I was not talking about the alleged fraud. I didn't say the word alleged.
The Inspector General can speak to what he can speak to regarding ongoing investigations.
Yes, we've been, since December, we have been doing an increased number of compliance visits. And so we've been out in January, went to the 100 largest centers by CCAP revenue and collected a sample of attendance records from every one of them. And we're in the process of reviewing those records. We went out in February again and went to some additional centers and then did some, went to family child care providers who were the largest recipients and some other programs that were identified in some of our data analysis as red flag indicators. And we will continue to do that in March. And so that's what we're doing. That's in addition to our normal investigative work. And so we've ramped up some of our efforts, you know, that involves sort of redirecting some resources so it slows down our ability to do some of our regular work. But that's what we're doing to make sure that we're getting at the concerns that the public has shared with us.
Thank you, Inspector General. Follow-up, Representative
Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you, Inspector General, for that answer. Appreciate that. As far as the rollout for the digital, electronic monitoring and checking in, how does that work? And then who gets to see that information at the at your office? Let's say you have a daycare with 100 children, and it's electronically kept track of who's in attendance. How does that information get to you? Is someone overlooking that and checking that, what, monthly? Or just walk me through some of those details, if you would.
Inspector General, or would that be a question for the director?
Yeah.
Go right ahead.
So, Chair, member, so we have talked about having this data, this attendance data. So now when we go out to do compliance visits, we have to go out and physically collect records. Even if the records are in electronic format in the centers, we have to go and have them downloaded and provided to us. So this will give us the capability of, in almost real time, being able to match billing records against attendance records. And we've been working with Minute to develop some enhanced data analytics capabilities so that we can more readily look at all the different data we have that comes from multiple sources. And we intend to, as we build this system, add the electronic attendance records information in so that my data team can go in and look for issues that show up in the data.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, one last question.
Certainly, Representative McDonald.
Is it possible then in this electronic entering that for someone to just check electronically that child was in attendance even though they weren't? And if they were, that's the abnormalities, I would presume, that you wrote in your expected outcomes of this program. Would that be a correct statement? And then is it possible that that could happen?
Inspector General.
So, Madam Chair, member, there are limitations with each kind of system that you put in place. And so the electronic attendance records, we will get the information that was put in at the child care center. We want to build some capability in that lets us do some looking behind when that data was put in, who put it in if we can identify it. So we're going to try to build some additional tools in so that we can look behind the data. But much like gathering attendance records, we have different investigative techniques that we use if we want to sort of get to the point where we're sort of get that absolute certainty, but that involves actually conducting surveillance and watching the number of kids that go in and out of a center and then comparing that to the two different data sources, billing records and attendance records. Those are time intensive investigations, but those are the types of investigations that we also do.
Thank you for that. Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. My question is, you mentioned compliance visits. So I'm curious if those are unannounced surveys, compliant visits like they are in nursing homes and assisted livings for the state of Minnesota. If you could elaborate on that, that's my first question.
Inspector General.
Madam Chair, member. Yes, all the visits that my team does for investigations, for program integrity investigations, audits, those are all unannounced visits. So no one knows we're coming. Similarly, most of our licensing visits are unannounced as well, so that's our normal practice.
Okay. Representative Zalesnikar.
Madam Chair, and thank you. My second question on, so on the, when you make the unannounced visit, should you find compliance issues to the point made early of if there was any entries that didn't match or something, whatever it is, it doesn't match what you see, then is there, you alluded to the only way you could know that is if you had a camera. So is that part of your correction plan to the facility that if you note something, then a camera is installed for that? Or what are the correction plans if there is a gap in what you identify when you do an unannounced visit?
Inspector
match billing.
Inspector General, and I'm wondering if for the benefit of the committee and for the public, because this is an area where we all have a lot of interest in preventing fraud in terms of attendance. Could you, maybe either one of you or both of you, walk us through the process of, like, you know, a regular license visit, and then what happens if something gets flagged or you get a tip, and then what is kind of the timeline? Like, just give us a little bit of an idea of kind of how that process works, and maybe some of the, as Representative Zalesnikar mentioned, some of those red flags that might prompt you to do another visit or ask for additional data that might be helpful for all of us. Inspector General.
Sure, Madam Chair, member. So I have several different teams that work for me. One is the licensing team. And so they go out and do unannounced annual visits in child care centers, and they oversee the counties who go out and do those visits in family child care centers. We also go out to the license exempt certified centers. Those are sort of the school based and some of the after school kind of programs. If the licensors on those visits see concerns around program integrity, about compliance, there's not enough children, they don't see attendance records, something that they're looking for, they'll bring that information back and share it with the program integrity team. With that team, we do a couple different kinds of investigations or audits, right? So these compliance visits are sort of the simplest thing we do, where we go out, verify that there are children present, the program is operating, collect attendance records, usually for a couple month period, and it's not always the same months when we go to centers, even on, you know, the say we might walk in one center and ask for April and May and the next center October and November, because we don't want word to get out that we're only looking for one or 2 months. With those, we'll compare the attendance records we receive against the billing records. We can establish overpayments. If the errors are serious enough, we think it's, you know, sort of crosses the line between errors and fraud, we can take action to stop payments, to disqualify people from the program. Our more extensive investigations involve using surveillance and then matching attendance records and billing records against what we see in the surveillance. Those, again, same kind of thing. We can stop payments, disqualify people, establish overpayments. Where we see something that we think is clearly fraud or close to fraud, we will refer those to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension for possible criminal investigation. And we talk to them regularly about whether or not they want to take the lead on an investigation or if they want to wait till we're done and then decide what they want to do at that point. So we have close coordination with them, but we don't do criminal investigations. We do administrative investigations. Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and other federal agencies do criminal investigations.
Representative Zalesnikar, do you have a follow-up, or was that? Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that information. That was really helpful. Can you define and kind of what are the qualities when you're going into do an inspection or I think you call them program integrity or whatever the visits are called when you're doing these audits for these 100 places and you see something, if what are your definitions for serious enough to stop payment if you see something? What is that? Is that an amount of money? Is it a number of children? Is there a parameter for that? You mentioned there was qualities for what the on how you're defining. I'm curious as to what that is. Inspector General.
Madam Chair, member. I think the most common example we see where we take immediate action to stop payments is if we go in and there are no attendance records at all. That's a clear program requirement, and if we go in and we ask for records and they don't have records for the period of time we're asking for, then we're likely to stop payment immediately and open an investigation. Sometimes that's the most common, and then if we see some really obvious concerns with how the attendance records are kept, if every month looks the same, every child is signed in and out at the same time, that's another reason why we might stop payment immediately and open an investigation. So those are the two most common examples I can think of where we would sort of get to that, what we would think is a credible allegation of fraud, and take action.
Great. Thank you for that. Representative Hicks, you are next, followed by Representative Altendorf.
Thank you so much, chairs. I want to make sure that I'm that for everybody, the public and ourselves, we're really understanding the difference between the CCAP program and attendance records and funding and licensing and issues around quality and care, because those are separate. So when you go in, do you go in with licensing, or are you just looking at attendance records and the CCAP piece, or is it joint? Like, how do those things interplay together?
Inspector General.
Madam Chair, member. So generally, the program integrity and the licensing staff operate separately. Their visits are not coordinated. We do have a program called Early and Often, where any center that's licensed, a newly licensed center in the first year, they're going to be subject to more frequent visits by licensing staff and program integrity staff. And part of that is we want to ensure that new providers understand the rules, that we provide technical assistance to help them ensure that they're meeting the licensing requirements, and separately that they're complying with any program requirements related to CCAP. Where we find problems that are serious enough, we will open investigations even on those visits. It's not a free pass, but the goal is to teach people the right way to do it and prevent future problems.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. For a little bit of context for me, because I wasn't here when Early and Often started, could someone help me understand the timeline of when Early and Often started, and then if there's any data points around Early and Often? So how many visits happened between licensing and program integrity during that first year, and what has the program shown us as far as data points? Or if we don't have them, we can get them later, but I wasn't here when that program was implemented, and so I'd love to know if that's working.
Director Sommerfeld, or do we have somebody else on staff who might have a little bit more detail? Otherwise, certainly can follow up. Inspector General?
Yeah. Madam Chair, remember, I wasn't here either. I came to DCYF with the Inspector General's office in June of last year. Early and often arose out of the concerns that were identified in 2018 and 2019. So it's been around for several years now. We can certainly come back with data if that would be helpful.
The chair will note that both chairs and the Speaker of the House were on the committee at that time when we reacted immediately and with urgency to the fraud concerns that were happening back in those years. Representative Hicks, any follow-up?
Thank you. That's really helpful. It sounds like I wasn't here, so it sounds like that program has been operational. So it would be great to see sort of what has been the outcome of that investment that was made by our chairs and our speaker. Thank you.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Inspector General. So my question is to you, and is it correct to assume then that you are responsible for the other inspectors within the child care system? If so, how many inspectors work within that department?
Inspector General.
Madam Chair, member, I have 55 licensing staff that go out and do directly licensed centers. We have a team of 11 that oversee the county family child care system. I have 20 people on the program integrity staff. There are three investigative teams with four investigators and a supervisor, and then some additional staff that provide support. I think that's what you're asking.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a follow-up question. From the daycare fraud and things that we've all seen very publicly, one of the things that was very alarming is that many of these centers don't even have outside playgrounds. You know, that was visible. That would be like a minimal red flag. And I think a lot of people in the public are wondering how something so obvious, you know, we're not even talking about the actual children being in the daycare. We're talking about there's not a playground at this facility. And my question is, has anyone from your department been removed or fired and been held accountable for the inspections that obviously were not done?
Inspector General, again, I think that Representative Altendorf is speaking to the alleged fraud. We do have a number of child care providers here in the audience that might have to leave soon, so I just wanted to give them a shout-out for joining us from St. Paul, Minneapolis, Duluth, and Burnsville. So you can respond to the question now, Inspector General.
Madam Chair, member. So the licensing rules don't actually require that a center have an outdoor playground on site. They have to have one within a distance that's specified in the rule, and I think it's couple thousand feet or so. The fact that you don't have a playground right there is not necessarily a problem. They have to have access to a playground, and the rules specify how close it has to be.
Thank you for that clarification, Inspector General. Any follow-up, Representative Altendorf?
Madam Chair, you didn't answer the question, please, of who has been held accountable. How many from your department have been held accountable?
Representative Altendorf, can you help us clarify what you're asking? Whom from the department are you asking is held accountable? Or are you asking about child care providers who are under current investigation?
Madam Chair and Inspector General, how many people from your department that you oversee has been held accountable for the lack of oversight and inspections? How many people within your organization?
Inspector General.
Madam Chair, member. Everyone in my organization takes program integrity serious. That's what we do. We created this organization and brought it to DCYF in June of last year. And we have used all of our resources that are available to us to continue to ensure that public funds are spent appropriately. I have not disciplined anyone because they're all working really hard to do their job the best that they can.
We have Representative Olson next on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Inspector General, so getting into this position in June, I don't know what you did before then, and I don't know how this program was in, you know, the administrative investigations were conducted previous to you coming on board as the Inspector General. But my question to you is, do you believe, obviously in the last 6 months of being here, are the pieces put together in an appropriate way in which this administration, this program, we are defending the integrity of it? Is your job, the way you have it, the way you're doing it, is that making it so that there aren't holes in the bucket, so bad actors aren't stealing from the taxpayers? Do you have what you need? I'm not saying, are you, I don't think you're responding. I mean, coming in June, trying to fix a problem, trying to you know, recap the sinking ship. Are there holes in the bucket? If there are, what do we need to do to fill those holes?
Inspector General.
Madam Chair, member, part of the reason I got this job is because in 2010 and 2011, I worked in the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families, helping them deal with the program integrity concerns we had then, same area as child care fraud. And so I do have some experience working in this area, and that's part of the reason I came here. I think Minnesota's in a much better place than Wisconsin was in 2010, and I think your experience in 2018 and 2019 has helped put some pretty strong controls in place. And I think we are always happy to talk about additional resources. For instance, now when I changed the work from sort of doing our routine investigations to doing compliance investigations, it's the same staff. I'm just redirecting them to do additional work. And so, but I will tell you that we are using all the resources we have, and we are certainly willing to talk about other options.
Thank you, Inspector General. And Representative Olson, you may remember that we actually provided some funding just last year for additional program compliance staff to the department as well. Go ahead.
Right. Last, just real quick comment. So I started hearing about this fraud before I was even in the legislature. KSTP did a story in 2019 talking about the CCAP fraud that we're running into as a state, and now it's rearing its head again. What you're telling me is that as of right now, your team has what it needs so that 7 years from now, KSTP doesn't have to do another story about millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of fraud. That's what you're telling me.
Inspector General.
Madam Chair, member. No, what I'm saying is I'm using all the resources I have to the best of my ability to address the concerns about fraud and financial misconduct in these programs. And could we do more? I think if we had more resources, we could probably do more things. And we're always happy to talk about that. I can't guarantee in 7 years that bad actors won't find a different way to come after funds in the system. But we know sort of where some of the problems are now, and we're trying to address them.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for being here. I have a question. In my district, I was contacted by some of my child care providers because there were strange men lurking around outside in their property trying to spy into their windows based on these stories they were hearing about there not being kids inside or whatever the case may be. And it really freaked them out. And so it was tough for me to go back to them and explain that under 25-year-old YouTuber had kind of started a little fire that didn't really give us a lot of information to go off of. I had very credible child care centers in my community who were accused of things that they had never done wrong. And it put an undue burden on these small business owners that are critical to the rest of my community being able to go to work and have their kids there. So just a really direct question for you, Inspector General. Can you help us understand if there's any credibility, anything I can bring back to my child care providers to say, this is why there were strange men trying to peek in the windows of your child care center. This is why they were doing it. And give me something that I can go back to them with, because I've yet to find anything that really made sense to me. Thanks.
Inspector General or Director, to the extent that you're able to share some information with the committee about any ongoing investigations, I think that we would all find that helpful.
Madam Chair, member, I believe you're referring to the Nick Shirley video that came out, right? And so you had a couple guys standing outside of child care centers yelling fraud and asking to come in. The people who operate those child care centers have an obligation to protect the children that are in there. And so we would have been concerned if they had opened the doors to strangers while children were present. That's part of their job, is to ensure that children are safe. And most child care centers keep their doors locked, just like schools do now, to ensure that children are safe. We went to every one of those centers after he'd been there and actually went in, because we're authorized to go in, and did actual investigative work at those centers. And then we went to a bunch of other centers, and we just went down the list of who gets the most money, and we went to everyone that was, the first 100 on the list, and that's where we started. And we're going to continue to do that, and we will always identify ourselves when we come. You'll always know who we are, and while we're there, we'll tell you why we're there. We try to get in and out with minimum disruption. But that's the work that we do, and we appreciate all the work that child care providers do to keep kids safe in the environment that we're operating in today.
Vice Chair Hansen, follow up.
Thank you. That's a great answer. I can go back to my community with that. So thank you very much for helping us clear that up. One other question that a constituent of mine asked me was when he looked at this, and I think everybody on this committee is going to know the answer to this, but I just want to be able to send this video to my constituent so he hears it from you, not from me. When he looks at the license of a child care center, and there are maybe some license violations or corrections or corrective orders they needed for maybe ointment that wasn't labeled with the child's name or something like that, where it was an inspection was done and they needed to fix that, can you just confirm on the record for me that those sorts of actions are not the same as fraud?
Inspector General.
Madam Chair, member. Yeah, the licensing process and licensing violations are separate from our program integrity work. Where either team goes out and sees concerns, they will certainly refer that to the other team, right? So if program integrity goes out and sees licensing concerns, they'll share that information so licensing can follow up, and vice versa. If licensing sees program integrity concerns, they will share that information with the program integrity team. But licensing violations by themselves do not indicate that there's financial misconduct.
Representative Lesnikar, if you can be brief. We just have another presentation after this, so.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, when you stated that you looked at the top 100 on the list based on the most money, I'm assuming billed. So from that site visits that you said you did you find anything that didn't match, or did the BCA, were any referred to the BCA of that 100 that you did? And what's the status of that for this committee?
Inspector General.
Madam Chair, members, we have taken action based on what we saw. Some of the centers in the Nick Shirley video were already under investigation, and some of the activities that were going on after that visit made it harder for us to do our investigations because parents were afraid to send their children. There were other people outside the centers, and so it disrupted some of our work we were trying to do with surveillance. But as we went to these centers, if we saw items of concern, we took action. We stopped payments at several centers immediately. And every center that we visited, we open an investigation because we have records that we have to review and audit. So we're continuing to do that follow-up work.
Brief follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is that public data like it is for a plan of correction with nursing homes and assisted living?
Inspector General.
Madam Chair, member, our investigations are not public information while they're ongoing, and then they're not available for public until after any appeal period is run.
Thank you, Inspector General. Chair West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple comments and then two questions, and then we can move on unless the Chair has others. When I talk to centers, this has been a big issue. One of the things they've mentioned to me is they get told a window of when an inspector is coming by. So they won't get told the day of, but they'll be given a window so that they can have their paperwork in order. So, which is concerning, because I wouldn't call that a truly unannounced visit. And I've heard this from more than one center. So I'm not sure if that's accepted practice, like going outside of your direction to inspectors, but that one, unless they're lying to me, that is happening right now. If you have a comment on that, I just want to condense things here. So with a lot of these centers that receive a million or more in CCAP, I had a bill last year, House File 1916, that had them install cameras for the specific purpose of having the department have access to them. Now, I know you talk about if there's a discrepancy in the attendance records, that you then set up surveillance. So how long does that surveillance take? And if we implemented that, would you, like say you had access to 28 days, 90 days of footage of people checking in and out, would that give you the ability to act faster when you're when you get these red flags?
That's a good question. Inspector General.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. So for licensing visits, one of the things that the licensors try to do to make the visit shorter and easier is to do some pre-work, so review training records and some other records ahead of time, and so they'll request those records before the visit, and so the providers will know, okay, there's a visit coming sometime, usually in the next 60 to 90 days, but they don't know the actual date. Our program integrity investigators don't do any advance notice. And so when we're going out to investigate potential financial misconduct, we don't provide any notice.
Sure.
You know, there are a variety of different ways that states have looked at for trying to figure out the best way to sort of provide information about who's there, whether it's biometric scanning, swipe cards, video, right? And so there's a lot of different options out there, and we're always happy to talk about those different options. Normally, if we set up a surveillance, we're going to try to cover at least 2 billing periods, so that's 4 weeks. And, you know, it still takes time to review records either way, right? So it's just, it might shorten it a little bit if records were readily available, but it's still going to take time to review the records and do the additional work.
Chair West.
So what, when an inspect, you mentioned the difference between the program integrity and the others. However, do the other inspectors who are not program integrity inspectors flag fraud? It felt like you mentioned that in your earlier statements, but say it's licensed for 132 kids, they show up, there's 7. You mentioned they give them forewarning, but wouldn't they still flag that fraud as even though they're not in program integrity, just because there's something like flagrant like that?
Inspector General.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and let me just backtrack for a second. I think on the early and often the first visit, they know they're coming, and after that it transitions to more of a traditional licensing type visit. If one of our staff go into a center, whether it's a licensor or a program integrity staff, they are looking around and they will notice, you know, what's going on. They'll look in classrooms, see how many children are there. And if there are concerns, they'll bring that back and share that.
Chair West.
So I would still have, with that in mind, I would still have concern about them having advance notice, because that is another opportunity. Especially because they are, you know, the legislature did move to ban kickbacks. That doesn't mean they don't happen, and there can be collusion between parents and the centers themselves, which could, if they know when this window is coming, make it so they can put a presentable foot forward. So I would consider that a vulnerability. Two, we will be bringing up this, well, as I mentioned, camera monitoring when it comes to tracking this attendance, in particular because you're going to have a lot better view of who's entering and exiting the facility when the cameras are within the facility looking straight at the doors rather than being monitored from outside. That'll provide significant fraud protection. And given the concerns that were brought up, this became a very big story, and if you had access to that footage, you definitely could have quelled a lot of concerns if indeed these centers did not have anything untoward going on. This department mentioned there were 4, I believe, that were under investigation for months. My hope would be, I'm assuming there is no comment you can give, is that when those investigations are concluded, that the department will make the committee aware as soon as it is able to, because that is of tremendous interest to the public. And the last question I have, you mentioned one of the flags is no attendance records. What is done if the center claims the attendance records were stolen and they don't have those attendance records? What happens in that case?
Inspector General.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. I can't remember if we've had someone make that complaint, that claim, since I've been here or not. They're required to maintain their records and have them available for inspection. If they have a police report that shows the records were stolen, we'd consider that in deciding what the next steps would be, but I don't have a specific answer to your question.
Chair West. All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. I do want to refer for the benefit of the public and for all members, just a reminder, because I'm sure everybody read the submission that the Department of Children, Youth, and Families made to the federal government after the Trump-Vance administration asked us for some additional details surrounding alleged fraud here in Minnesota. Response number four, since 2019, 1,042 CCAP investigations have been opened. This figure includes a range of compliance investigations and should not be construed to reflect the number of investigations involving suspicions of intentional fraud. The number of total investigations include cases generated by random audits, tips and referrals, cases identified by data mining, and concerns raised through the Early and Often program, a targeted program that supports and reviews newer child care programs for licensing compliance. DCYF issued administrative sanctions in 426 cases within that period. The administrative sanctions range from an order of corrective action to disqualification and various discontinued payments. Since 2019, 46 child care assistance cases have been referred to the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension for criminal investigation. Cases are referred to the BCA when intentional cases of fraud are suspected or identified. So of those 46, we're not sure how many were actually then filed from the BCA, but I think that's a very small proportion of the number of tips and audits and everything that you receive, and obviously do your team does due diligence into those. So we really appreciate you coming before the committee today. I think this was really helpful. More conversations obviously regarding electronic attendance monitoring and program integrity will continue throughout the rest of the session, but appreciate you being here today. And with that, Inspector General Keyes, are you the one who is going to be talking us through the regulation modernization, or passing on the gavel to the other chair? You are, right?
So I am,
yes. Take it away. Thank you.
Just going to move so I can see the screen. All right, I'm going to talk about child care licensing modernization. And this is a process that's been ongoing for a while now. And the committee's heard about this several times over the last couple of years. But we're going to try to hope to bring it to a conclusion this year. As I get started with this, we were asked to talk briefly about sort of the relationship of licensing and quality and how we think about that. We look at licensing as that foundational level of service that every child is entitled to in the state of Minnesota, and that's to ensure that children are safe and they're in a healthy environment, and the environment provides that baseline of service that allows them to develop and support healthy growth socially, emotionally, and physically for children. We think that is part of health. We don't see a place where you can draw a clear line between health and safety and quality. And because licensing is universally applicable, we want to ensure that it provides that baseline level for all children. And then from there, there are quality initiatives that currently exist across the department. We have programs set up to allow providers to provide levels of service above the minimum standards that licensing have. The slide shows you some of them. Parent Aware, it's Minnesota's quality rating and improvement system. We have a fee reimbursement program for child care programs that seek accreditation by private organizations. And then there's training, coaching, scholarships for staff, and scholarships to help them retain staff. So all of these programs are designed to build on that quality baseline that licensing has established. In the child care modernization directive that we received from the DHS, received from the legislature, and that I've inherited, there were three parts. The first part was the weighted risk system. The weighted risk system is designed to ensure that licensing sanctions and violations are sort of correlated. So we look at the violations across our licensing rules, and we look at the violations that are the most serious risk to the child's health and safety. And those get weighted with a heavier score, and then as licensing items are less of a risk to health and safety, they get a lower score. And we assign values across the spectrum, and then we align our licensing sanctions with the risk score. So if you're at the low end of the spectrum, you might get a correction order or some technical advice on how to fix something. If you're at the high end of the point scale, where what you're doing is an immediate threat to the life or safety of a child, we might take immediate action to close a program. These weighted risks were developed using the existing rules. Over 2,000 people participated in that process to develop the system. And if the standards are changed going forward, then we would need to reevaluate the licensing standards and apply them to the same system. The abbreviated inspections portion of this modernization process was looking at ways to minimize the intrusiveness of the inspections, but still ensuring that children are safe. We look at the provider's compliance history. So if they have a good compliance history, then they'd be eligible to participate in this abbreviated inspection process. We have a series of things we look for. The first thing are key indicators. Those are a few licensing rules that we know if people get those right, they're likely to get the rest of the things right. We also look at the most serious things, tying back to our weighted risk system. So the things that are the greatest risk to health and safety have to be inspected. Then there are supplementary rules that we're required to inspect to ensure that we meet our federal obligations to ensure we can qualify for the federal funds. And then the system would generate several additional things for the licensor to look at that the licensor wouldn't control. So that provides some randomness to the process. And then the piece that we want to spend the most time on today is the licensing standards. And this is the part where most of the work has been done over the last year or two. We were told in the legislation that standards must protect the health and safety of children, be child-centered, family-friendly, and fair to providers. And so we took those sort of four criteria and we tried to put them into, I call it operational sort of concepts, something that we could evaluate against as we were looking at the rules. And so the first thing we looked at was, can we simplify and streamline these rules? Can we make something easier to understand? Can we make it shorter? Can we take something out? Do we need it in here? We tried to increase transparency for families to make sure that families had the information they needed to understand what services were being provided and what conditions their children were going to be in. We had to meet federal requirements, and so those are things that the federal rules require in order to qualify for funding under the Child Care Development Program, which pays for CCAP and some other programs. We wanted to reduce the burden on businesses where we could, and the touchstone for all of this was always to ensure that as we did these things, that children were safe, and it was a healthy environment. As I've said, you've heard about this before, it was going on for a while. The feedback process is outlined in the slide. This program transferred to DCYF in June of 2025, and we continued the outreach that was ongoing. We did 50 in-person sessions and virtual events after last spring's draft. We did a statewide survey and then 12 licensor focus groups. From all of that feedback, we worked to develop a report and a draft proposed legislation for you all. And the report and proposed legislation that you've been provided, we've also sent out to over 20,000 people anyone who was ever asked to be involved in this process got a copy of the report and the proposed legislation. And that was over 20,000 people. And they got that in early January, shortly after you got a copy of the report. This is what we propose to do in this process. We currently have two rules, one that governs child care centers and one that governs the family child care programs. And then there's an existing statutory provision at 142B. Our goal after this would be to have a statutory provision that covers child care centers, one that covers family child cares,
And then we'd restructure and make changes to 142B so that it focused on what the department's roles and responsibilities are as the agency providing oversight to this system. Some key changes, and the report is about 26 pages if you don't consider the proposed legislation. The report lays this out in a really nice, clear way, and so if you haven't had a chance to look through it, I really recommend it. I'm just going to hit the high points. The first thing that we want to do across both child care centers and family child care centers is strengthen the attendance tracking requirements. Right now, the attendance tracking requirements in both programs is linked to whether or not they're participating in a funded program. And we were just talking about CCAP, so participation in CCAP would require them to have attendance records. If you're not participating in one of those funded programs, you don't have to have attendance records. And we don't think that's right when it comes to keeping children safe. If you're a family child care provider and first responders are called to your home, because they see children outside and no adult, and they go in and the provider's not responsive, how do they know how many children are there if there's not attendance records? So we want daily attendance records that reflect all the children that are there that day. And it also helps us in the future if we have to do investigations to understand who was there and not have to rely on the provider's memory. We think that most child care centers have records, but we want to make sure that every child care center has attendance records. And we want to go one step further than just having records where you sign in at the front. We want tracking records in the classrooms because we receive too many reports of children being left as children transition from classrooms to outside play space or from play spaces back into the classrooms. And so we want attendance records at the classroom so that as the staff move back and forth, those attendance records go with them, and we always know which kids are supposed to be with that provider. And that also helps us to understand whether or not programs are complying with ratios. You know, did they have the right number of staff for the number of children? If we don't have records in the classroom, then it's only what we see on the day we were there, and it's hard to go back and try to recreate the system as it existed if there are complaints. So attendance record tracking in the classrooms we think is important. Transparency, there was in the last session, there was some discussion about radon testing, radon mitigation. We've opted to recommend sort of the middle ground, which is we want to create a form that explains what radon is and what the risks are. And we want each provider to tell parents whether or not they've tested for radon, and if they have tested, what the results of that testing was. That way parents understand what the environment is that their children are going to be in, and they can make choices about whether or not that's a risk that's acceptable for them. We also added a couple other notice requirements, one about the presence of animals in a program. Parents should know if there are two pit bulls in the backyard or not. I'm not picking on pit bulls, but that seems to be the breed of dog that's involved in a lot of incidents.
Sounds like you're picking on pit bulls.
But we want parents to know if there are animals, if there are animals present in the program, and we also want parents to be notified if there are any injuries related to contact with the animals. And finally, something that people didn't think about when these rules were drafted 20, 30 years ago, we want clear policies on social media and image sharing. Parents should know if providers are going to put pictures of their children up on the internet and when they're going to do it, and we want parents to have a say in that. And finally, we've want to, in both program types, have clear language around what's acceptable behavior guidance and what's not allowed, and also ensuring that the programs are supporting children with special needs so that children with special needs are able to participate in all parts of the activity. And one of the things we're trying to simplify is if there's a temporary sort of accommodation need, a child has to wear a brace, a cast, a helmet because of an injury, that the program doesn't have to go through a whole detailed process in order to address that. They can do it very simply, but we want them to make sure they do that. Okay. In the child care centers, and now I'm just going to focus on child cares for a minute, we simplified and reduced the staff qualification requirements. In the last 2 years, each of the last 2 years, we've given about 4,400 variances for teacher qualifications so that staff could start in a teacher position without meeting the full requirements that are in the rule. And we similarly gave out about 700 each year variances for assistant teachers to start in that position without meeting the full requirements that are in the rules. And we already had sort of an established variance standard, right? If you met these minimum standards, we would grant a variance. We want to get out of the variance business, and we want to make it easier for providers and directors who are running these centers to be able to hire staff. It was one of the biggest feedbacks we heard from child care centers is it's really hard to hire staff. It's really hard to find qualified staff. We want to be able to bring in staff and grow them and develop them. And so we want to simplify the requirements so it's easier for programs to do that. We also, just sort of part of a trade-off for that, we want to increase the qualifications around the director. So the person who's running the child care center has to have a higher level of qualifications. We want to make sure that the right now you can be 18 and be the director. We think 21 is the minimum because we want adults supervising adults in these child care settings. We've made a slight reduction to the number annual hours of annual in-service training, but we also want to add a training for every new staff in child care centers to ensure that they have a basic level of training, so a 2 to 3 hour department level department-developed training that every new staff would be required to take, so that we have sort of everyone understands the minimum requirements to work in a child care center in Minnesota. One of the other things we heard a lot about was the complexity around the rules related to what types of equipment they have to have, how many of each type of equipment, and we want to get away from that sort of prescriptive system, and we want to get to rules that focus on developmentally appropriate activities. We want the kids to be able to engage in learning, music, reading, other activities. And so instead of trying to figure out how many blocks they have, we want the programs to ensure that for each of these types of activities, the children have at least 3 choices when they're choosing to participate in those activities. We stole this idea from Wisconsin. It works there. It's pretty easy for the programs to understand. It's easy for the licensors to understand. Separately along the health area, one of the things we were requiring children to do is get a physical exam to come back to the child care center after the first year and every year after that. There's no other requirement in statute for children to have a physical exam. It's not our job to tell parents when they should have to access medical care and creating a burden for parents. So we took away the requirement to collect annual physical requirements. They have to have initial screen to come in so we know everyone has their vaccinations, but we're getting out of managing health care for people. Similarly, we've reduced the requirement for providers, for child care providers, to collect information about who the dentist is or who the doctor is, because they don't call these people if something happens to the child. They're either going to call the parent or they're going to call 911. And with HIPAA, they're not going to be able to get any information for these providers, so why ask them to collect information that they can't use? We've reduced the frequency of health consultant visits. These are people that help set up, the initial program of care for diaper changing, feeding, et cetera, in the programs. Right now, the rules require monthly visits. We think that can be reduced and still ensure that children are safe. And then one of the things that we think is really important is making sure that the rules around food allergies are clear and strong, because that is a life and death matter for a child with a severe allergy. In outdoor play areas, and we want to ensure that there are safe areas around climbing equipment and other areas where children are subject to fall. We want to have some energy-absorbing material under that. That's standard at schools. It's standard in parks. We think it should be standard in child care centers. And then, finally, the fire marshal wants us to ensure that child care centers are inspected every 5 years for fire hazards. They do that in other facilities, and they want to do that for child care centers. In the family child care area, we streamlined the number of licensing classes and increased capacity for some of the larger program sizes. That's a big thing we heard from people is we want more flexibility, and so we've added in most of the licensing classes an additional toddler or infant number in there to provide that flexibility. Because we're expanding the capacity, and because we're providing more flexibility in those licensing classes, we want to pull the variance approval level up to the state level. Most of the variances at the county level are around, can I have an additional child And we think we provided that additional flexibility already, but we also want to ensure that the rules are uniformly applied across the state. And so we'd like to pull that up. I've talked about capacity. Similarly to what we did in the childcare centers, we've clarified some of the rules around activity and equipment, again, while maintaining flexibility for providers. We reorganized the training requirements because our current rule has you have to go to three or four different places in the rule to figure out what training you have to do if you're the provider or if you're a substitute. We restructured it so that it's clear for each role what the initial training requirements are and what the continuing training requirements are. And then we reduced the number of continuing education hours again by several. And then we added fire prevention training every 5 years because that's just a risk that we want to make sure everyone understands and is able to respond to. On overnight care, we've added and clarified the requirements so that it's clear what you have to do if you're going to provide overnight care in your home. And the last thing is on parental, again, letting parents have information so they can make choices. We want to require that family child care providers notify parents if there are firearms in the home. They don't have to tell them how many firearms, don't have to tell them where they're stored, but we think parents should understand what risks are in the home, and that's something that especially the young parents on my staff feel really strongly about. I just want to know so I can make a choice. And so we think that's important for parents, again. There's already a separate licensing requirement for them to be stored and locked, and that's something that's subject to inspection by the licensors. But we want parents to have that information again so they can make choices. So that's sort of the high points. As I said, the report provides a lot more detail. This is where we are in the process. We think if you make changes to the standards that we'd need about a year to get the training in place, to do some interpretive guidance, to make sure that the providers understood what the changes are, and to make sure all the different licensors out there understand what the new standards are that they're enforcing. So we would ask at least to July of 2027 before these went into effect. And I think that's the end of that presentation. Tried to do it quickly.
Thank you. We will jump to testimony and then run through questions. So Cindy Cunningham and Claire Sanford are the people on the list. We'll start with Cindy Cunningham. Is there anybody else here that would like to testify? If you can just give me a quick hand raise, just so we know. Okay, that really helps us budget. All right, when you're ready, Cindy, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. Once Ms. Sommerfeld gets out of the way, I mean, come on.
Picking up. Greetings. Cindy Cunningham, family child care provider in St. Paul for almost 30 years. Been around the block a few times. I have the script. You have the script. What I really want to say is thank you for getting it to this point. And to Mr. Key's comment, this is going to get done this year. Lead and Care is the nonprofit that I am on the public policy. I'm on the board for public policy. I have done public policy here for about 15 years and was at the beginning of this. I sat in the room with the Family Child Care Task Force in 2019. When all these things came forward, we had deep conversations, spent lots of time and effort. I'm one of the few that still is here and coming back. We've got a couple legislators. One is sitting in the corner that's not serving right now. But, you know, people are still engaged. So the biggest piece is this needs to get done and through. Sorry, I distracted myself and you both. The pieces that really need to be looked at, we have outlined. We have worked hard with legislators. We've worked hard. We did the halt from the first draft that came out, and people have asked, are you going to do that again? No, we need this done. We need the abbreviated license. We need the weighted risk. All of these things need to be done. There are individuals such as myself who have been through the whole process, and we have new staff that are trying to get it across. And I think what has been presented in the proposal is good but not good enough. So hence, we have put forth this leading care in consultation with lots of other providers and lots of discussion with Tony and the fire department, with all of the DCYF folks. So I would hope that there's a bill that's brought forth. My goal is that there's a bill that's brought forth that won't take too many amendments. So trying to work towards the end for that. There are some critical pieces that we want to do, but one of the things I wanted to take the time to raise up right now is that when we worked on this in 2019, where'd my numbers go? 7,400 licensed family child care providers. Today, 5,400. That's a loss of 20,000 potential minimal slots. People talk about the child care crisis. They want to dismiss the family child care loss has anything to do with it. I disagree with it. What we would like to raise and continue to bring to discussion is the state tax rolls pay a lot of money to support, a lot more money to support centers than family child care because it's spread out over the state and supported by the counties. We would like to think that at some point in life, some of this gets looked at differently. During the pandemic, I was told, go shop, go to the restaurants, go to wherever, about where I want to see, for the places I want to see in existence after COVID. I think the state needs to take a serious look about how much money is being invested to support and promote family child care versus centers and school-based care. So that's kind of that part of it. We would like to entertain some of the questions related to the high points. We went through the whole amendment. We have detailed tweaks and pieces that are there. The chairs have both had that, as have other members. I'll share it with anybody about what we would like to see different. There's an ongoing meetings with the department and anybody else who wants to talk with us. And, you know, to get that across, what is in my testimony is some of the critical high points. I guess we'll wait for questions maybe rather than going through, however you want me. I was supposed to keep it to 2 minutes. I don't do 2 minutes. I described it as a three-legged race. And often it has felt like a three-legged race of the tripping along and the falling and trying to get it together and picking back up and pulling back together. I think we're at a good point. The good news is that versus rulemaking, as 9502 is, we get to come back every year and tweak it. You're welcome, or not, I don't know. So if we don't get it 100% right this first round through, we have the options and opportunities. We would really like to get something that's close to better. So thank you.
Very much, because then we get to fiddle with them. Ms. Sanford, we welcome your testimony. Please introduce yourself for the record and continue.
Thank you, Mr. and Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Claire Sanford, and I'm the Government Relations Chair for the Minnesota Child Care Association. And I have to say, it's fun to be back in this committee. This is a fun committee for the new members. There are high chews, the candy that sounds like a sneeze but hopefully tastes better. I've never actually had one. This might have to be the session. No, I'm not asking for one. Don't worry.
Yes, Mira,
we need some assistance.
Too late. Anyway, okay.
You know that.
Uh-oh.
There's no way you didn't know that was going to happen.
Thank you. I'll take a look when I'm done talking, because I'll
probably
have to
idea.
Choose my flavor well. And is it a gum? Is it not? I don't know. Chair Katiza Watun's son could tell us. Anyway, the Minnesota Child Care Association is a statewide nonprofit membership association of licensed child care centers. We care about affordability for families, safety and educational quality for kids, and compensation and support for the professionals who provide these services. And we have been extremely excited about the regulation modernization project, and still are, but it has dragged on, and it has to get over the finish line this session. We've waited nearly 40 years for major updates to child care licensing standards and methods, and we truly can't wait any longer. Provider frustration, of course, is something that will be addressed by this project. Clearer, streamlined expectations and citations based on the risk they pose to health and safety will be so welcomed. As a parent, if I saw hazardous materials available to children or equipment not in good repair on a center's licensing history,
it would certainly give me pause. What people don't see in the current system is that often the hazardous materials were baby wipes sitting on a counter, and the dangerous sounding equipment was a play kitchen stove with one missing knob, not the same as giving kids bleach or a playground slide about to fall down. This has real reputational and financial effects on both family and staff recruitment. But it's not just those. Our current system is helping to drive a real financial crisis of insurance for child care providers. Insurance providers look at licensing records and see the above, hazardous materials available to children, et cetera, and it directly translates into providers being dropped from or denied coverage or rates increasing exponentially. All of this is tied to increased costs for families and increased risk for providers. If you can't get insurance, you stand to lose your home, your retirement, everything, if something happens. And there are many stories of providers in such situations. These alarm bells started sounding a couple years ago, and the stringency of insurance carriers has only increased. Last year, this committee had written testimony, not heard, had written testimony from a local insurance professional pleading for a better licensing system after working with child care providers in tears when their coverage was dropped, not because of an insurance claim, but because of a minor licensing issue taken out of context. To that point, I'd like to note that DCYF's report to the legislature that's being discussed today stated that the intention is to wait to implement the risk-based weighted system until the new licensing standards are also implemented, no earlier than July of 2027. I'd also like to note that the report states that the weighted risk system could be implemented earlier to the current standards we have now if the necessary technology was in place. And I would encourage this committee to direct DCYF to do that, because providers should not have to wait another 18 months in light of these financial and insurance challenges with the current system. That's the weighted risk system. The updated licensing standards. I feel like Ms. Cunningham, thank you for getting us this far. While we need the weighted risk system to be in place while we await implementation of new licensing standards, hopefully passed this session, the new draft standards submitted to you are a tremendous improvement over both current standards and earlier DCYF drafts of these standards. The draft currently in front of us provide more standardization and more flexibility, both of those things, in many areas. Health and safety pieces are clearer and updated to current realities, while basic items related to the educational and developmental experience of children allow for a wider variety of program philosophies and environments. They allow for some cost savings and a lot of time savings. We want center directors in classrooms observing and coaching teachers, responding to families, working to support children with special needs, hiring and training new staff. We don't want them counting blocks, measuring mirrors, or chasing parents down for the name of a dentist their baby doesn't have and will never use, to Inspector General's comments. These are great things. Obviously, we still have some questions and concerns about the latest draft. And we'll have that conversation this session. Staff qualifications are decreased in this draft, as was mentioned. And I understand the reality of the variances that have been written. But, you know, we want to consider that more. Minnesota has long been known for high licensing standards, and we know that teacher quality is the biggest factor in safety and quality for children, and that strong standards are also part of the program integrity conversation. We want to talk about how staff training requirements might interact with staff on leaves of absence, particularly in light of the new paid leave law. We want to continue to talk about appropriate use of time outside of a classroom as part of behavior guidance. And more guidance will probably be needed in flexibilities in equipment and materials. We love them, but also we don't want to get a citation for doing the wrong thing. So we both want more flexibility and more clarity. You can't please us, we know. But in general, this is a very good base from which to have these conversations and revisions this session, and we look forward to working with you and DCYF to bring this into fruition, because it is long overdue. Thank you.
Strawberry gonna be okay?
Mango. Mango's better.
I had grape for the first time today, and it was delicious.
Thank you. So under ineligibility factors, family caregivers are required to have 12 months of abstinence if they have received treatment or therapy. Is the department going to ask providers whether they have, you know, been in therapy or treatment? And say they had when they were a teenager, would that still apply in this case? How is the department plan to implement that?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to phone a friend.
Please introduce yourself to for the record and answer the question.
Hi, I'm Alexandra Keyes. I'm the Family Child Care Licensing Manager at DCYF. So the language that you're speaking about is in our current rule. Generally, this comes up if we have an incident involving chemical use that happens in the family child care. We would ask the provider to provide records showing their abstinence, and then we would issue something called a chemical use variance, which is where we kind of review the documentation and to make sure that they are fit to provide care.
So for documentation of abstinence, what's an example? That's proving a negative, as it sounds like to me. I'm sure there's a...
Yeah, so generally it would be, and just to say, since I've been here, we haven't had to issue any of those variances, so it doesn't come up very often. But generally that would be documentation that they are in some kind of treatment program or have had some kind of treatment program. And there are some instances where we have providers who need to call in to a county... it's called the color wheel, where they will call in to for random testing. So we might use that as verification of abstinence. So it kind of depends on the situation.
Okay. Another question is the regulations require that providers check every 20 minutes, even if they have electronic monitoring with a camera to see that a child is, you know, sleeping peacefully. I don't check on my own children every 20 minutes. I think that's a pretty high bar to hold a caregiver to. What's the rationale? Because how did the number 20 minutes get landed on, I guess?
Chair, members, I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head, where the 20 minutes came from. We do have it currently written in statute that regular checks are encouraged as part of our safe sleep requirements, and we wanted to make that language more robust as a requirement, but I can't speak to where the 20 minutes came from. We can find out and get back to you, though.
Well, as we go through the legislative process, we'll come with that. Go ahead.
No, Mr. Chair, I just want to add that that's some of the comments we've gotten from some of the provider groups, and we're looking at that again and to see if we've hit that in the right place.
Okay. And on the weighted risk system, we've been waiting for the weighted risk system, and it seems like it's being pushed out until after new regulations are adopted, but it's also crucial for insurance purposes. Is there a reason that, why... The weighted risk system seems like it's all ready to go, but is still not being implemented. And as you heard from the providers, it's they need relief, particularly in the market of insurance, which this can provide. What timeline are we looking at having that weighted risk system done? Say we don't even get modernization done. I don't think we can wait on the weighted risk system. So what are we looking at there? If modernization doesn't get done, is there a plan? And if modernization does get done, when will it be achieved?
Mr. Chair, we've talked about that internally, and so what we're trying to avoid is having to do the same work twice in a short period of time and, you know, have a changing standard right after we've implemented it the first time and then change it to adapt to new rules if we have new standards. If at the end of this legislative session there's no changes to the existing standards, then we would look at rolling out the weighted risk an abbreviated inspection system, as soon as we could. If there are new standards, we prefer to only have to do it once, and so we would propose to do that again once the rules were effective. But we can do the preliminary work during that transition period so that we'd be ready to roll it out pretty shortly after the effective date of the new standards.
So pretty shortly, as in weeks, months? Yeah. I can forgo more questions. Representative Coulter, would you mind?
I don't have any questions. I don't want to take away time from. I just Just very briefly, I just want to, first of all, thank Mr. Keyes and the team at DCYF. This is, this has been a lot of work. I know you've really put your shoulder into it. I know many of us were sort of concerned that this was just going to be rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. And I'm greatly relieved to see that that is not the case, that this is real, I think, substantive improvement on a system that, that really is not, excuse me, just really not working well for providers or families, to be frank. So I am relieved that this is moving forward. I think, Mr. Chair, to the points that you and others have made, I think there are some things that we can tweak, some things that I think can be done differently, and that's the genius sort of the legislative process that we have that ability. So I think, you know, moving forward, there are some things we can do, but I also just want to emphasize how important it is that we get something done this year, and not just because I'm going to be the one carrying the bill, but because we know folks are waiting and have been waiting and expecting this for a long, long time. The other thing I want to just raise, and I certainly would not call this a criticism, but I do think in terms of the way we look at quality and education of providers, the way this is structured right now, it is not, I think, fundamentally moving us in the direction that I think we should be, which is to treat providers more like educators, which is what they are. And so I think that will come forward as another proposal, and it's a conversation that we're going to need to continue to have. But I think we have a real opportunity to build something together that's going to do a lot more, that's going to serve folks better, and is going to treat providers really like educators. So I'm excited to do this work. Thank you.
And also, I didn't mention because we're in a hurry, great work overall. I kind of skipped over that to the questions, but seriously, you did some quality work. Representative Hansen.
Well, Chair, you stole my thunder. That was what I was waiting this whole time to tell you, is this was amazing. I think we've heard a lot of people for a really long time talk about a lot of the things that you've brought forward today, and I think there's a lot of things happening in the news, a lot of rumors going around. I feel much, like, so settled in being able to, like, have solid information and a great contact. DCYF is amazing, best agency in the state, I'll just say it. I just think that, like, the standing this up as a new agency and everything new that we're doing is really impressive, and I think it's important. Don't tell OCM I said that, because they will be upset. So thank you. Good job. I see it. I recognize it, and I'm just excited to continue working with you all on this. Thanks.
Representative Nadeau.
And a ditto here. A lot of admiration for the work that you guys have done and the willingness to continue to engage with providers, and I think it's super smart, and to continue to do that, if it's on the waiting component or not. I do have a couple of particular questions, and one, I think it was, I thought of it after Chair West brought it up. There was a violation that I recall. It was in my district. It was someone that consumed alcohol on a site, but that facility got the citation, but the employee moved to another facility, and it didn't follow the employee. And so can you just talk about that for a second, and how is that addressed in the new thing? Is there anything we can do with that or not?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, member. So generally the violation goes to the center, so the director is responsible for what happens in the center. And so if a staff brings an alcoholic beverage in, the staff was probably fired, but that's not something that would end up being reported. Our background checks look at, you know.
They self-reported it. That was at the time they had to self-report, and so it stayed with the facility. Sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, that's fine. I mean, a lot of our information comes from self-reports. We appreciate when providers are willing to let us know when something's wrong, and we take that into consideration as we think about the sanctions. Again, the background studies is where you would see that. I mean, short of a reference check where one provider told the other why they let that person go, and people are less willing to do that nowadays. But no, it wouldn't create a record for that employee just because they got fired.
Representative Nadeau.
And just the final, one. When you were going through this, and I think Representative Coulter kind of alluded to this, possibly going forward, did you look at different licensure, maybe a tiered licensure between more care-based facilities and academic-based facilities? We're seeing it. I have a lot of different facilities in my district. Some are very, very classroom, scholastic-based facilities, and they're treated same, similar to any other. And did you guys look at differentiating those or not?
Mr. Key.
Mr. Chair, member. No, we for licensing, what we look at is trying to establish a baseline standard that all the centers can operate under. And I've been out and visited centers across the state of Minnesota and visited a variety of centers. And we're not trying to sort of dictate a particular model of operating. We want to provide some baseline standards so to ensure that children are safe and then provide the flexibility for programs to structure it, whether it's an outdoor-based program, a religious-based program, whatever the providers, how they want to structure their program is up to them. And we don't want to get into the business of having multiple license types depending on how the program wants to operate. We want one clear standard that we can enforce across the state. The one place we've sort of talked about is in family child care, that what we call now special family child care. Is there a space for a small group kind of license that sort of straddles those two things? But that's not within the scope of this work, and we wouldn't want to tackle that this year if we're going to make these changes. But it's something to think about as we go forward. Is there another band in between large group centers and family centers that we could address?
Thank you.
So I stopped using your names because when Ms. Keys came up, I thought I had your name wrong this whole time. And I got educated. So any relation? Okay. All right. Representative McDonald.
Very encouraging, your testimony and the plan that you set out. But frigid weather, winter weathers, and the snowstorms aren't the only thing that Minnesotans are worried about. It is the high cost of daycare, one of the highest in the nation. We can be proud that we're one of the safest in the nation, but we can't be too proud of having the highest. Over $15,733 per kid per year for a family. Your chairman, West, will tell you his whole salary here goes to the daycare. We have to get that down. In your work groups and interviewing with participants in the centers, are you able to bring the cost down, hundreds if not thousands, so we can at least be competitive with our neighboring states whilst maintaining safety and making things affordable? Because it is not affordable, it's a big word, affordability, but that's one of our key things in the legislature. We want to make things more affordable for our future generations, our children. Are you able to bring the cost down and save parents thousands of dollars with these improvements?
Mr. Keys.
Mr. Chairman, member, we did what we could within the licensing realm to try to reduce the burden on businesses. There are a lot of cost pressures on providers, and when I was in Wisconsin, I also oversaw licensing in addition to program integrity. It's like the same job. That's part of the reason I was interested in this. And so I've talked to a lot of child care providers over the last 15 years. There are a lot of cost pressures, right? And we all know that when COVID came, there were pressures on wages. We have minimum wage laws now. People are not as willing to work for low wages in some jobs, so that's there. We have shifting demographics that puts pressure on the business model that providers have. So we tried, within our small piece of that problem, to try to minimize the regulatory burden where we could. And as we talked about staff qualifications, tried to align the requirements where the workforce is today and where providers are finding the workforce so that they could employ people that were willing to work. But I can't guarantee that the work that we're doing is going to change the cost of childcare for parents. Because I only have a small piece of that bigger puzzle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess that'll be our continuing job here in this committee.
So, unfortunately, we have run out of time here. Members, please submit your questions either directly to DSIF, the Department for Children, Youth, and Families, or to our lovely CA, and we will get the questions over and we'll get those answered. We may, depending on if we can get those answers in a timely fashion, we may bring this up in a future committee hearing, but with that.
So before we go, I do have a few notes for committee members as well as the public who is interested in tuning in. Next meeting is Tuesday, February 24th. Chair West will have the gavel. Going forward, we're going to do things a little bit differently this year with the schedule. So the GOP will have the gavel on Tuesdays, and the DFL will have the gavel on Wednesdays. Please, members, put the child care report in your saved folder, since we will be coming back to this, and it is a hefty document. And also, please clean up after yourself. We have lots of candy and snacks in here, but it is not the staff's job to do that, and as well as, like, just the room turning over. Just be respectful of our staff, and our gratitude goes out to those who help us take care of the space. Thank you, and we are adjourned.